You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome back to the DMZ, everybody.
How was your respite?
Good. It was weird not talking to you, but I assume you got the mini postcards I sent.
Did you feel untethered? Did you feel like you didn't know what was really going on in the world?
I was, it was rough. We pulled through, but yeah.
So I will expect you offering more, sloppy, knee-jerk, oversimplistic analysis of the Democrats because you haven't had me to yoke you back to reality and give you the properly nuanced take that I know you, that nourishes you.
Yes. Well, hopefully, after today. And we did tape a podcast a couple days ago. An audio podcast, Matt Lewis in the News, so that helped prepare me, get me in the right state of mind for today.
The best part of me doing your podcast is that you let me talk.
Yeah, actually, the irony is on my podcast, you talk more.
But we had a good chat. I feel we only scratched the surface. We talked a fair amount about the state of the Democratic primary, and we have other things to talk about today, but. I could have talked to you for 3 hours. I feel like I know we never get enough time, despite the fact that I talk to you more than any other human outside of my family.
Yeah, look. Again, I've said it many times. Adam Carolla, Dr. Drew, Tony Kornheiser, Michael Wilbon. There's just certain pairings that people can't get enough of,
right.
and I would say our own Bob Wright, Mickey Kouse, would also a close second behind us.
Now, you told me that one of our super fans is curious about the books that I sit in front of on this show. For those of you who watch the show on bloggingheads.tv or on YouTube and aren't doing the cheaters route listening to podcasts, I do sit behind my presidential library for most shows. I think I've touched on some of the books on a past show, so this might be old ground for some people. But I do have behind me, I have a book on every president now. I'm still doing my collecting, but I do have every individual president covered in some way in this library.
So there's at least 50 books behind you.
Oh yeah.
45. 45.
I think more than 45 behind me. And I got other books scattered around the house and in my office. But I do have a couple treasures here. One of them is the Thomas Woodrow Wilson, A Psychological Study by Sigmund Freud and William C. Bullitt. And this book is, some argue that Freud didn't really write this. It's really more Bullitt. I think it was published after Freud died. But it's basically, Bullitt was, I think he was ambassador to the Soviet Union in the immediate aftermath of the Communist Revolution. And he was pissed at Wilson that he didn't give him enough authority, I think, to recognize the Soviets, if I'm remembering the story correctly. What I do remember is that Bullitt came back and totally screwed Wilson on the League of Nations. And dropped a dime on the Secretary of State, who was trashing it privately, trashing the treaty privately. And he teamed up with Freud, who, to some degree, helped him basically trash Wilson, claiming he was, psychologically, damaged, which led him into World War One, and the debacle of the League of Nations. I also have the memoir of his second wife, Edith Bowling Wilson. If you watch Drunk History, you know that she is sometimes called the first female president of the United States because she was approving and vetoing some legislation while Wilson was incapacitated by stroke. And that's a very glossy version of her story. And that was, in large part, the basis of the 1944 film Wilson, which I think was nominated for Best Picture. I don't think it won. But that was part of the resurrection of Wilson's reputation during World War II and a resurfacing of interest in the in having United Nations. That made Wilson look a lot better. I also have here the complete story of his assassination, the life of William McKinley, and the complete story of his assassination. This came out right after he died. So it's kind of falling apart. If I open it up, the pages will probably disintegrate in my hands. But that's a good one. And I also have the William Jennings Bryan memoir, the First Battle, which he lays out his whole theory of the case in the aftermath of I think his first presidential loss. I mean, those are some of the best ones. I mean,
that's a Robert Caro there behind you.
I do not. I have no Robert Caros behind me. I have Robert Dalek's.
This is the second volume
of Lyndon Johnson. It was Lyndon Johnson biography, Flawed Giant, which covers the presidential years up to his death. And I also have Dalek's Unfinished Life of John F. Kennedy. This one here, this is, you can't even see it, it's the presidential campaign of 1860. This was written around the turn of the century. This claims to be the first academic analysis of a presidential election, of a presidential campaign rhetoric. Those are some of my better little nuggets, hard to find nuggets in my library.
Very cool. So I'm reading David Petruccia's 1920.
Oh, I have that
right now.
Do I not have it here? I do own it. I must have it on a different
really good book
shelf. It is a good book. He's hard on Wilson. You know, I love Wilson. He's not very charitable to him in that book.
Yeah, not a big Wilson fan.
You know, he has a style of writing that's very cinematic. I think that was written to be easily turned into screenplays if someone was going to option it. And so that book is about the 1920 campaign, where he says, you know, you had essentially six presidents coming together. Teddy Roosevelt, who initially was going to run but then died before he could. Herbert Hoover, who was in the Wilson cabinet at the time but was in the mix for the Republican nomination. FDR was on the ticket as VP in 1920. Coolidge was on the ticket as VP under Harding. And Wilson was threatening to run for a third term despite recovering from a stroke, which not everybody fully appreciated the significance of, but he was not having a hard time letting go, even though he was deeply unpopular at that point. So how that all came together, and the scene of how Harding gets the nomination, which is one of those, you know, 30 plus ballots decide in the cigar smoking back room is a fascinating tale.
Have you been, Bill? A lot of people don't know about this. Have you been to the Woodrow Wilson House here in D.C.?
I have not. I'm very mad about that fact.
Yeah. It is cool. I went there a few years ago, and it's interesting because Wilson's wife lived there for decades. In fact, she entertained Jacqueline Kennedy and other first ladies in that same house, obviously decades after her own husband left the White House. But a lot of people don't know about it or haven't been. My wife and I went there a few years ago, and the tour guide was giving us kind of a rather perfunctory tour, and then I started dropping a little bit of knowledge, and she was
nice.
Like, okay, game on.
Nice.
The tour guide was like, okay, now you want to do this? And then it became like really cool tour. What is it? What's the slur that that Donald Trump uses against Elizabeth Warren? Pocahontas, right?
Yes.
So it turns out Mrs. Wilson was, I believe, related to Pocahontas,
wow.
Like in real life.
Wow.
That was one of the things, and there's some pictures or statues or something there. Anyway, check it out.
All right. Well, now that I've done my little library tour, we probably should get down to business.
Yes.
So a lot of talk this week that the economy is not going to be Donald Trump's friend, that we might be on the cusp of a recession, the market's very jittery. Trump himself flinched on escalating the trade war with China and didn't slap on another round of tariffs. It would seem that if Trump was going to win re-election, the economy is like the one leg he has to stand on. Do you think he has any prayer if the economy goes into any sort of downturn next year?
I mean, this is becoming conventional wisdom, but I think it's correct that Trump has benefited so much from this strong economy. It's given him almost a sense that, like, he can do no wrong, and that, you know, we were told if you impose these tariffs, if you attack people on Twitter, that the markets could get jittery, and it hasn't happened. So there's almost a mystical, magical quality about Donald Trump. It seems like he's been so lucky, and, you know, he's treading water. He's still not that popular, but with a strong economy, it seems like the odds would favor him to be reelected. And if you take that away, Bill, I think that maybe it's like a house of cards that just comes, you know, crumbling down.
Now, I'm inclined to believe that, but just for devil advocate's sake, we've already seen anecdotal examples where Trump says he's going to save a plant. The plant gets shut down anyway, and the workers say, well, that's not Trump's fault. You know, he was fighting for us. He was doing his gosh darnest. You know, he's the only one who's looking out for people like us.
Yeah.
And we know from the flip side that the fact that he has a good economy has not altered his poll standing. People who don't like Trump continue to hate Trump, even if their own economic situation is good. We know that there are a lot of evangelical Republicans who have become very attached to Trump because he's waging culture war nonstop, and that is something that is unrelated to the economy. So if you like Trump for non-economic reasons, or you believe that Trump is fighting an uphill economic battle, but his heart and intentions in the right place, and it's external forces that have thwarted him, and you know Trump's going to blame everybody else. Oh, the Fed did this to me, and those China bastards, they did this, and the media, they're sowing discord and sowing disunion, trying to talk down the economy. Wouldn't people who love Trump anyway? And even if that is not a majority of the country, if those votes are allocated in the right states as they were in 2016, he could still win anyway.
Yeah, you know, you present this plausible case. Trump has pulled off miracles before, and he's very adept at blaming other people. So, yeah, you make a compelling argument. I guess my pushback would be two things. One, we're only talking about a few thousand votes in Michigan, let's say, or Wisconsin that may make the difference this time around, Pennsylvania. And so anything, even if it just affects things on the margins, could be the difference between winning and losing. And so the difference between a Trump with a strong economy and Trump with a weak economy, even if it weren't, he didn't go into a sort of Herbert Hoover-esque malaise kind of situation, that could still cost him the election. But I would say a certain amount of Trump's appeal is premised on this notion that he's magical and that he's a winner and that for some reason he's lucky. And there are tipping points during presidencies. I mean, George W. Bush had for a long time had the wind at his back, and at some point the accumulation of things, whether it's Katrina, whether it's the Iraq War, whatever, they can eventually wear you down. And sometimes you don't notice it. Like, you don't notice the gradual erosion of support. It's actually more of a tipping point that happens quickly all of a sudden. And so that would be my pushback. But you may be right.
Well, I'm not saying like that is right. I think I generally am more where you are than the devil's advocate argument. And let's also keep in mind that Trump is routinely tried to ride every bit of economic good news as if he is the sole reason for it. Every stock market bump, every unemployment number, every GDP number, it's always because this is what I did. I have, you know, cheer-led this economy. I've stood up to our trading partners, the tax cut. You know, I gave you this great tax cut. Look at all the wonderful things that it's doing. So, you know, certainly on paper, under normal circumstances, it would be very hard to suddenly pivot and say, oh, now the economy's bad. All those things that I took credit for, well, I have nothing to do with all the things that have gone wrong now.
Yeah.
When George Bush had his economic crash in 2008, you know, you wouldn't be right to say the tax cut created the economic crash. But if you're saying tax cuts give you wonderful economies, but they prove wholly ineffectual at stopping other economic threats, well, then what good is that tax cut? So there are a lot of things that Trump has said that can be very easily thrown back in his face if there is a bona fide downturn. It just depends. Will anybody's mind be open enough to listen to it? Is there a soft Trump vote? People that voted for Trump the first time but aren't totally drowning in the Trump Kool-Aid. Case in point, an Iowa soybean farmer, for example. I mean, those are the folks who are, China is now not taking any American agricultural exports. Those are the folks who are really getting in the teeth right now. And it's one thing if you're jerked around for a bit and then Trump backs off and it's all kind of okay in the end. Maybe you forgive.
Yeah.
Next year, then maybe you don't forgive.
Yeah, no, I think that's the exact point, which is so much of this is when does, you know, a president's policies take years to sometimes come into fruition. And so Trump could be messing things up that we won't realize until he's gone. And he said that in terms of the debt and the deficit, right? He's acknowledged that. And so it may be that he has done some bad things that actually will have repercussions years from now, and it'll be too late. But the question is, when do these things hit? Remember, George H.W. Bush is punished because of a recession. In fact, the economy had started to turn around, but it was too late to help him.
Right.
Reagan has a recession in 82, but then there's enough time to recover in time for the 84 landslide reelection. With Trump, and I'm not rooting for a recession, I don't think that's really a responsible thing to do, but with Trump, timing is so important. And if what does the economy look like in November of 2020, that's a big deal.
Right. I mean, if I'm going to try to quickly, you know, Google it while I talk to you. Right. So the Bush recession, technically speaking, began in 1990 and lasted through March 1991. So we're actually technically out of recession after March 1991. But the aftershocks of that were still being felt. So unemployment continued to rise through June 1992. So even though you had a nominal recovery after that point, you're still feeling it on the ground throughout the country, and you couldn't easily talk it up by the time you voted in November 1992. So if something hits in the latter half of 2019, it seems almost a certainty that, I believe it's first and second quarter GDP,
yeah,
which are the most telling indicators of how the election's going to go. This is why
people run for president when it looks helpless or hopeless, right? So George H.W. Bush had like a 90-some% approval rating coming out of the Iraq, the Gulf War, looked like he was unbeatable. And then, of course, Bill Clinton, you know, so Cuomo doesn't run. Other people don't run.
Al Gore, and then Bill Bradley.
Yeah. They sit it out and Bush loses. Clinton wins. And the same thing could be true of Donald Trump, who, depending on how the economy goes, could be much more vulnerable than we think. I mean, as And until a couple days ago, I was operating under like the assumption that like if I had to bet, I bet on Trump, you know, that I just the odds are he probably wins re-election. Not a slam dunk, but if you have to bet, you bet on him. But this would be this would definitely change that. And then I think you could see I think that this could embolden Democrats who would maybe gain some confidence, maybe have because going against Trump, you kind of need confidence.
Well, if you had a profound downturn and literally every Democrat in trial heat is beating Trump by double digits, that would rob Biden of a unique electability argument. I mean, so there's already talk out there. It's been driven by Nate Cohn at the Times and Dave Wasserman, who writes for Roll Call and NBC and the Cook Political Report. I think it was an NBCNews.com piece that he did this, saying that Trump could win re-election despite losing the popular vote by, you know, as much as 5%. So you want to have a trial heat where you're well ahead of 5% to feel good that this person's in good shape. Well, if they're all ahead by 5% because Trump's in the dumps, well, then why do you necessarily need Biden? You could throw the long ball with Bernie or Ward. Now, but here's another wrinkle I want to add to that, though. Which I don't think is being talked about very much. I just mentioned earlier the plight of the Iowan soybean farmer. Warren and Sanders are pretty squarely in they wouldn't use this term themselves, but let's talk straight. They're in the protectionist camp. Warren released a very detailed trade strategy, which, and if you're curious about a critique of it, you can read Dan Dresner over at the Washington Post. He's written a couple of columns about it, one that responds to critiques of his first critique. But she says this very plainly. She wants trade agreements to have standards that are above not just what the other nations currently have in terms of labor, workplace rights, environmental protections and such, but higher than America's current standards on that score. I mean, if you're raising the bar that high, you're basically saying we're not going to have agreements. We're gonna just essentially go with what we have. And one could argue, so what? You know, we can live with where we're at right now. But I think she even raises the prospect of withdrawing from current agreements that don't live up to these standards, which would not be a status quo. Now, Warren seems to be aware that running on a unvarnished protectionist platform is not good politics in Iowa, because at the Wingding a week or so ago, where most of the candidates gave short speeches, she said to the crowd, forgive me if I'm not quoting it exactly right, you don't win a trade war by tweet. Which is an appealing message for that Iowan soybean farmer who really wants to, who does not want protectionism, who wants to sell their crops abroad. And she did not go, and she includes in her strategy, I want to have consumers and farmers at the table. You know, she doesn't talk about protectionist terms. She talks about it in small D democratic terms. I want to open up the process. I want to bring the people into the process. I don't have secret negotiations that the corporations have undue influence in. Well, that's all well and good, but you know the farmer's interest is very different from the steelworker's interest and the ironworker's interest. So it's the job of the president to mitigate all the competing interests and come up with an agreement. And she doesn't really explain how she's going to balance all the competing interests in her strategy, except for the fact that the bar is being raised so high that you're probably not going to have any agreements at all, and you might well withdraw from existing ones. So having said all of that, we had a poll, a post-debate Iowa poll, where Biden was at 28, and Warren was coming up in second place at 19. And you had a national poll just yesterday where Warren was at 20 amongst registered voters who say they're going to vote in the Democratic primaries, and Biden was at 23. So you can cherry pick those two polls and say it looks like Warren has got the mojo. Now another national poll came out yesterday that got less attention, where Warren was in third place at 10% and Biden was at 31%, and Bernie was in second place. No one's talking about that poll, so I don't know if it's a certainty that Warren really is on the cusp of being the clear second place person. But let's say for argument that she is, and particularly in Iowa, does Biden, who is maybe not completely in the free trade camp, but he talks more about we need to write the international rules or China's going to do it for us. That's one of his standard talking points. He threw a wrinkle at the last debate that he wasn't going to stay in TPP as is, but he certainly is interested in renegotiating TPP and really being in it in a way that makes you feel like he really wants to be in TPP. He's not looking for an excuse to get out of it. Does he throw a trade hardball at Warren if she is gaining on him in Iowa? Does he make a hard play for the Iowa soybean farmer? Look, I want to get your crops to Asia, and Warren's going to make it impossible. So that's a way that the economy could hurt a Warren candidacy.
That's where I want to get at with you. I'm really curious about this because I think that there's a psychological aspect to this, that Donald Trump seems very lucky, almost magical. Like, he got away with the Russia stuff, and Mueller couldn't, they thought they had him, but he escapes. He tweets things that are very dangerous about North Korea and China, and but it doesn't roil the markets. It hasn't caused anybody to bomb us. He seems to be like immune from this. Like, there aren't any consequences for his action, and I could say the conservative dogma has basically been that what an economy needs is reliability, the predictability. And Trump is anything but predictable, and yet the economy has been buzzing, humming along. Let's say that there were a downturn and Trump were to start looking more vulnerable. Maybe this time the jig is up, right? How does that impact the Democratic race and the jockeying?
Well, again, I think that if he looks like a sure loser, you will see an even more robust pushback against the electability argument vis-a-vis Biden. That anyone can beat him. You don't have to be a bedwetter. You don't have to worry that Warren's agenda or Bernie's agenda is too ambitious. It doesn't play in Peoria. You know, Biden is so Trump is in such bad shape. Just go with your heart. Just go with your heart. I don't know if you can ever convince the majority of Democrats not to panic. Cause there's a lot of Democrats they don't trust polls. You know, I trusted the polls last time and I got burned. Sure, he may not look good too good right now, but I don't know what's going to happen a year from now. And I also think that there just is a bona fide moderate faction of the Democratic Party that disagrees with Bernie and Warren on the merits. Now, I think sometimes where it can get confusing, it's hard for me to talk about it in certain definitive terms. But because that moderation is intertwined with electability arguments, I think in some cases the Democratic moderate likes to talk about their concerns of democratic socialism or Warren's economic populism in political terms so they don't have to say, I just don't agree with them. I just think they're wrong. You push the blame onto some other unnamed voter without a face, and you're saying, you know what? I just don't believe in single payer. I just think it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Now you're starting to see more and more Democrats do say things like that. I mean, because Biden has kind of led that charge. That's bad to take away the health insurance from people who private health insurance from people who like it. So if Trump is in high 30s and is being beaten by everybody, you still might see Biden and others say, you know what? That's still not a good reason to go Democratic socialist because you could throw away a sure thing. And you know what? They're just wrong on some stuff. They're peddling ideas that people in the middle of the country just don't like, and I don't like, and you shouldn't like. So I don't think it's a given that the electability argument goes by the wayside. But certainly those on the left would prosecute it, the anti-electability argument, even harder in that circumstance.
Yeah, good stuff. What else we got?
We had other ideas when we were.
I can do it. Let me do it. While you think, I'll do a couple shameless plugs.
Okay.
That I think are somewhat of a segue, or consistent with what you were just talking about. Actually, John Delaney scheduled to come on the podcast. Congressman John Delaney, former Congressman.
Yeah, I am more excited about that podcast than your Andrew Yang podcast because you know Yang is someone. You know, they're both interesting that they both have a lot of ideas. I think Yang is more of a. This might be too harsh, but you know, a bit of a bottom feeder. I mean, he's taking sort of every idea, every wild idea, and trying to play to every fringe podcast listener, and try to cobbling that into enough of a donor base, squeeze out 2 or 3% of the polls, and get in the debates to hang around, but isn't really advancing. The ideas discussion. We're not in a great debate about universal basic income because Andrew Yang is in the race.
I think you're too. It doesn't surprise you that I think you're being too hard on him.
Now Delaney, I think is eclipsed in the moderate lane by Biden, but I do think he has laid out a pretty articulate critique of the Bernie Warren posture in these debates. And I think has belied the notion that moderates don't have their own ideas because he has a whole bunch of ideas and they're not even all that moderate. I hope you ask him about this. I think his climate proposal has gotten a real short shrift. Cause he's for a carbon tax and dividend. So you impose a tax on carbon pollution and with the proceeds you give it to taxpayers. It's sort of like George Bush texted. Here's a check. Isn't this awesome? You get a check. I think there are political obstacles with that plan. I don't think it's a total slam dunk, but it's he has got a modest amount of Republican interest in that proposal. There are business leaders that are for a similar type of proposal. And the one thing I would ask you to him, ask him. Does he agree? I think the business coalition is a climate leadership coalition or something like that. They propose a carbon tax with legal immunity from climate-related lawsuits. Would Delaney support that quid pro quo with the business community to get that passed? I'd ask him that, and I would ask him. There's some kind of academic paper that came out recently that suggested that you could not make the carbon tax high enough to actually drive down carbon pollution enough in the time frame that we need. And so there's some people who are anti-carbon tax or pro-Green New Deal that are pointed at that and say, you know what? Of course the Exxon and Shell are for a carbon tax now. They know it's not going to hurt their bottom line. It's not going to make them change very much. I'm curious what he thinks about that argument.
No, you're good stuff, and I think he's been surprisingly eloquent in the debates. I think he's actually had a couple really strong moments. I'm also talking to, assuming it goes through, former Congressman Joe Walsh on the podcast
now,
tomorrow.
Is he seriously thinking about running himself? I know he talked about the Trump Shire primary challenges. Is there talk that he's going to run himself?
I'm going to ask him about it, but I think if you read that New York Times op-ed, it suggests that he might be thinking about it.
Can I make a confession, Matt? I've been glomming on to the New York Times login from an old employer for years, and that login changed, and now I don't have – I'm trapped behind the New York Times paywall for the last 3 days. It's horrible. Like, there's one publication – like, there's so many times a day where, like, I want to click on something, and I can't click on it. Because I'm behind the paywall. And I've used, like, all three of my browsers. And I've used my iPhone. And I've used my iPad. And I'm still stuck. So I haven't read it. I don't know exactly what he said.
So it seems like it may be an opening salvo. He briefly talks about how he voted for Trump as a lesser of two evils. He talks about how he has in some ways contributed to some of the problems today and his past political activity. So it seems like maybe he's kind of inoculating himself against that charge. And it really, you know, goes after Trump in terms of policy and ethics and morals and everything, and essentially argues that there needs to be somebody taking on Trump from the right, unlike Bill Weld, who, by the way, since it's a Matt Lewis plug day, I'll be interviewing Bill Weld next month.
You're on fire.
In Austin, Texas, for the Tribune Festival. It's sort of a call for somebody to take on Donald Trump from the right in a primary. And, you know, maybe it'll be Joe Walsh, maybe it'll be Justin Amash, maybe Mark Sanford. I don't know, but he's saying someone should do it.
Number one, when you're in Austin, I want you to get some chicken fried steak at Threadgill's and tell me all about it, because I want to relive my experience.
Yes.
from almost 20 years ago. Assuming Threadgill's is still there. I imagine it's still there.
Love me some Austin.
I think you should ask Walsh, are there any... He clearly has some regrets about his tone, maybe some of his choices for rhetoric, because he was pretty horrible when he was in Congress himself and shortly thereafter. Are there any issue positions he's outright changed in the after seeing, you know, an unbridled Trump in action? Is there anything that he has changed his view on in the past couple of years?
Yeah, that's a good question.
One thing we could talk about is the gun debate.
Yes.
Now, it hasn't been published yet, and for all I know, I'm just getting my initial not edit back. My editor is saying that I wrote too much. You got to turn it back a little bit. So it's still in still in the editing process. I don't know when it's going to be published, or maybe they'll say it's terrible. We're not going to run it at all, but. I am in the process of making a case that if Democrats are really serious about passing gun control legislation, that they have to really run on it in a very high profile way. And you can look back at the Sandy Hook situation, where between 2004 and 2012, Democrats really kept their distance from gun control,
and they won the House. I mean, and it worked.
Well, they so Kerry, Kerry doesn't win 2004, but he was for the standard Democrat gun control positions, but he ends the campaign going goose hunting to try to say,
where can I get me a hunting license?
Right. Say, hey, hunters and sportsmen, it's all good. I'm not going to take away your guns. That doesn't quite work. 2006, you had a number of candidates who stayed away from gun control, like John Tester and Jim Webb, and they win.
Schuller.
They flip seats in 2006. Obama, and around that time, there's also a book called "Whistling Past Dixie" by a political scientist Tom Schaller that basically argued, look, you're going to get killed in the South on God, gays, and guns. You can't do anything about your positions on God and gays, but guns. You can capitulate on guns, and that can help you in the interior West and the Midwest. And Obama essentially does that. When the Supreme Court ruled in the Heller case that there's an individual right to bear arms, Obama agrees with it, essentially. Doesn't challenge it, says it essentially comports with his rough general views, although argues that it allows for some reasonable gun control measures, but doesn't challenge it. And he wins some gun-owning states like Colorado and Indiana and Iowa and North Carolina. And then in this first term, we had the Gabby Gifford shooting. And we had the Aurora, Colorado movie theater massacre. And we had the Fort Hood shooting. And all those times, Obama doesn't push for a robust gun control, nor do the congressional Democrats. It's not a major issue in 2012 against Mitt Romney. And Sandy Hook happens right after the election. And Obama understandably concludes, we just had 20 elementary school kids massacred. I can't do the same political calculation. I don't have to run again. So why not, try to take this moment and get something passed? And the harsh reality is that there was no mandate for that. He didn't run on it. There was no mobilized group of people ready to put pressure in the states and districts that mattered. And the NRA had been cultivating a diehard gun rights culture and community for decades, who were prepared to withstand whatever was thrown at them. And even though now we know they had some internal divides themselves on the subject, but they still came out very defiant, very harsh, and held the line. And I would not argue that it's a given that you could run on gun control and win. Now, there are people who'd say, look, Democrats did run on gun control and win in 2018. You had 15 Republicans with A ratings from the NRA lose their seats to Democrats with F ratings. You had Lucy McBath, who was whose son was killed in gun violence, who won in suburban Atlanta. Jason Crow was pretty diehard gun control in Colorado, where gun control even passed in Colorado under Governor John Hickenlooper after they had, you know, a spate of shootings. So this shows you can run and win on gun control. I think it shows you can run on gun control, nominally. There were not a lot of races. You know, Lucy McBath is kind of an anomaly there. Most of the races in 2018, gun control wasn't the issue. It wasn't the issue that the race turned on. There are a couple of examples. For example, Dean Heller lost his Senate seat in Nevada. Gun control was pretty prominent there. Kelly Ayotte in 2016, really, Heller and Ayotte's vote on the background check bill that was defeated in 2013, that was an issue in those races. Those are relatively blue states. And they are exceptions. I would caution Democrats that you don't want to have happen to you what happened to George Bush in 2005 with Social Security privatization. He ran Social Security privatization, partial privatization. But it wasn't the thing, and it was misinterpreted as, oh, well, I said it, and I won, so then that means I get to do it. And found out the hard way that doesn't automatically mean that. So if you want to have a mandate for gun control in 2021, and look, I don't think, I'm highly skeptical we're going to get gun control now, despite Trump's.
There's also the opportunity cost, too, right? If you do, you can't do everything. Everything can't be a priority. And so, you know, you've mentioned this to me before, Bill, that after Sandy Hook, Obama, by pushing gun control at that moment, which was understandable, but immigration, which there had been some momentum building for immigration, gets put on the back burner.
I mean, I honestly believe this was the biggest mistake of the Obama presidency, and a totally understandable mistake. But in hindsight, the Republicans were staggered on immigration with the Romney loss. It was widely accepted that Romney's push for self-deportation was terrible in winning Latino votes that were needed to win. You had Sean Hannity saying in the immediate aftermath, the Republicans have to get on with the immigration reform. Boehner was on board with it. They could have, you might argue that they would have lost anyway, that the Republicans would have found a way to oppose it, maybe, but you would have definitely been in a much, much better position going right out of the box with immigration reform in January when you had Sean Hannity agreeing with you. And instead what happens is you go headlong into gun control where you don't have your ducks lined up. Republicans, conservatives get their bearings on immigration. So even though the bill passes the Senate, it passes in June after Obama has lost some political capital and momentum with the Manchin Toomey gun control, with the background check bill losing in April. And then the right, including Sean Hannity, hammers that Senate bill and it doesn't get to the floor in the House. So
I think time was very important in that immigration bill, that if they had been able to do it quicker, they might have passed it.
So look, if Democrats run on gun control in 2020 in a big way, and that means, in my opinion, not just when the mass shootings happen, every day. You mentioned every day the gun violence that happened in domestic violence situations, in street crime, in accidents, everything. Because the majority of gun deaths are suicides. You know, you've got 36,000 gun deaths every year, 22,000 are suicides. And even of the homicides, two-thirds of the homicides are handguns, not assault rifles. So if you're talking about the everyday violence, the suicides, the handgun deaths, and you do that in all the states, it's not just the president, it's the congressional candidates, the Senate candidates, in the purple states, and you win on that, then you can say, okay, five Republicans, you know, don't you filibuster this, it's going to come raining down on you. You're going to end up like Kelly Ayotte and Dean Heller, and you're going to lose. So you better get right on this issue. I think then you got a shot. If you treat it like one of a bunch of issues that we talk about every so often, and yeah, I ran on it, but it wasn't the thing, but hey, we won, so let's give it a go. I think you end up with a Social Security privatization deal.
Yeah. But I think you've just explained why it's not likely to happen and hasn't happened, because of all the things Democrats could talk about doing, this is not the most popular if you care about winning elections. And especially if you're going to talk about suicide and crime as the main drivers of gun violence, or the main primary examples of gun violence, because I don't think that there are people clamoring to stop, you know, suicides with guns. It's not a top 10 issue.
Certainly. Well, it's certainly not today. I mean, the thing is, right now, we care about it mainly when there's a public mass shooting. There's a national trauma that's on our TV screens, and we're not sensitive to it when gun violence happens. That's not on our TV screens. You know, except conservatives saying, yeah, you're not talking about Chicago, you racist. That's the only time something else besides public mass shootings, you know, comes up. If you want to, one of the problems with only talking about it after public mass shootings is there are idiosyncrasies with each event. So we're talking about background checks right now. The Dayton shooter, the El Paso shooter, they would not have been stopped by background checks. Other Dylan Roof would have it. So it's not like I'm saying you should do universal background checks. There are examples where it would have helped, but it's not helped in every situation. And you can talk about assault rifles in certain cases, but there are also mass shootings that happen with pistols, semi-automatic pistols. If you don't talk about the everyday violence, you miss things that your proposals are relevant to. And so it's easy for them to say, well, you shouldn't do this proposal, it doesn't match this case. But the downside of that is it leads you into areas where the polling of it currently is not very good. Look, even the assault weapons ban, which polls pretty well, it doesn't poll pretty well in every section of the country. So in 2013, you know, Manchin Toomey was a really, really modest background check bill. And it had support from like 90% of the country, and it had support from 55 senators and majority of the Senate. And it loses on a filibuster. So that might compel some to say, well, your problem is the filibuster. Just get rid of the filibuster. Who cares about all this other stuff you're talking about, Bill? Just get rid of the filibuster. You get that thing through. With something like background checks, which it polls extraordinarily well, but is pretty minor policy. Sure. Maybe getting rid of the filibuster would be sufficient for that. Assault weapons ban? There was a vote on that in 2013. It got 40 votes. You had several Democrats and some who were still in the Senate. John Tester in Montana, Michael Bennett in Colorado, Mark Warner in Virginia, who did not vote for that. Joe Manchin didn't vote for that. I don't think Doug Jones would probably vote for that in Alabama if he's still around in 2021. So if you want to get the bigger stuff passed, you have to move the needle. You have to move the needle, not just in the big cities where they goose your poll numbers, but in the redder, lightly populated states that are disproportionately influential in the Senate. And you could very easily argue that it's not worth the electoral risk to do that. But if you want to pass that legislation, you have to take that risk.
But the key is beating Donald Trump. That's what most Democrats care about. And so that may be, an inverse relationship there.
Absolutely. It would be a big risk to bet a lot of chips on making that the issue. Yeah. But everyone keeps asking, you know, why does nothing get done? Well, you want to get it done, you have to invest the political energy to build the movement for it. And look, if Democrats say, you know what, it's not worth that. That's not worth that risk. There are a lot of other issues that have just as much import. Healthcare kills people. Climate kills people. The immigration crisis kills people. So people dying across the border. Not to mention a whole millions of people who are living as second-class citizens. These are all important things too. And you know what? 30,000 gun deaths. It's horrible, but it's not everything. And we got to make decisions and make priorities. If that's the internal calculation, I would totally get that. But if you want to actually do something about gun control, you got to lean into it.
I've missed our talks, Bill. I just wonder
did I get this at home, Matt?
Not to this degree. I wonder what did America do last week when we were not having our dialogue? Like how did people kind of cope with the news? It must have been really challenging.
I think that you lived on C-SPAN tracking of Iowa State Fair food choices. I mean, that might have gotten you through the hard times.
See, yes.
Turkey legs and deep fried PBJs. corn dog can get anywhere, but you know, you want to see I just want to say something here, Matt. All this talk about the Iowa State Fair, million people over the course of a week and a half. Next month, Matt, you have a bigger fair right here in Western Massachusetts, the Big E, 1.5 million attendees every year, much deep fried food on sticks.
Is this for the important Massachusetts caucuses that are first in the nation?
Well, you know, Massachusetts is close to New Hampshire, where there is an important primary coming up. And this is a New England fair. There are people that come from a large radius to the Big E, because it's the New England agricultural, you know, showcase.
So will you get some candidates?
I don't think so. I don't think there is a, you know, local newspaper soapbox event the way the Des Moines Register has the soapbox, because it hasn't traditionally been a political event. But I'm saying a candidate should show up. Okay, should go there, bring their own soapbox and make a speech, because not only is New Hampshire, you know, coming up, Massachusetts on Super Tuesday. And I would not assume that Warren has that locked up. You know, she has not polled well in Massachusetts in some of the earlier polls. Now her polls are getting better, of course. So she probably.
All right, well, I'm calling on Andrew Yang and Joe Walsh and John Delaney.
Bill Weld should be out here.
And Bill Weld and even Justin Amash to go to that fair.
Still clinging to Justin Amash. You're not letting that dream die.
You know, keep hope alive, Bill.
I think so if it was a race between Trump, Weld, Walsh, and Sanford, who do you vote for?
Trump, Weld, Walsh, Sanford. I probably go Walsh.
You would forgive him for his past?
I think so. Nobody's perfect, but I think Walsh, you know, I'm a fan of his work with the James Gang and the Eagles, and that'll get you a long way with me.
All right, anything else? Well, you already had your plugs. Anything else you need to mention before we sign off?
I think I've plugged so much already, but how about you, Bill? Anything?
I got you.
Piece of Real Clear Politics.
Oh, I did have a piece of Real Clear Politics this week. Yeah. We talked about a little bit on your podcast, but my argument is that there's not enough room in the primary for both Sanders and Warren, that they are in each other's way. If the left wants to maximize its influence in the primary and maximize its chances of derailing Joe Biden, they can't both stay. However, neither one has any incentive to leave because they have enormous donor bases. They're both polling well enough to justify staying in. So it's going to be up to voters themselves to get into one camp or the other if they want to have their best shot at having a bona fide progressive populist or democratic socialist at the top of the ticket.
Check that out. Bill Scherr, great to be back in the DMZ with you.
Great to have you here. I try to keep it tidy for you. I will be on a working vacay next week, so I think we can still talk.
Okay, awesome. Well, the American public needs us, so we'll see you back in the DMZ next week.
All right, take care.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.